versus the Virginia Board of Medicine. Good afternoon, Doctor. I think you were here when we last had a pro se litigant here. Same rules apply to you. You have 15 minutes. You can elect to reserve some time for rebuttal, which would allow you to speak after the counsel for the board has spoken, but you have to divide up your 15 minutes. If you tell me how much time you think you might want to reserve, we'll set the clock so we can tell you that you're into your rebuttal time, but other than that, the 15 minutes is yours and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could have 5 minutes for rebuttal, that would be great.
All right. Just allow my clerk to set the clock. And before you get started, I think sometimes with these administrative appeals, the record is pretty voluminous and it can be somewhat confusing. I just want to make sure I understand your argument. As I understand it, it is you don't disagree that if somebody did what was alleged regarding making false statements to patients regarding medical records or withholding medical records, that that would violate the two subsections that the board found were violated. You contend that the evidence, you contend that you didn't do that, but you concede that if you had done the things alleged, that would be a violation. Is that correct?
I absolutely concede that if those acts were committed, that would be inappropriate and a violation.
Okay. Floor is yours.
Thank you for that entry. So it is my belief that the substantial evidence clearly shows that I did not do the acts which I am alleged of having done.
Substantial evidence is a legal term of art, and it's not a weighing of who had more evidence or what have you. In an administrative appeal, what substantial evidence means is that there was some evidence that would allow a rational board, in this case, a rational fact finder, in this case the Board of Medicine, to conclude that a violation occurred. One of the patients specifically said she made a request for records, was told that they were coming, and they weren't coming. If that testimony is believed, and I know you believe that, and I know it is your position that it's not accurate, but if that testimony is believed, why does that, why that could be substantial evidence? Do you agree that the record has those statements from the patient in there? When she testified,
patient C. So patient C sent me personally an email requesting her medical records. I responded from my cell phone, got it, and will have it done, I think was the exact language. I forwarded that on to the practice, which was the custodian of records per Virginia.
What was your affiliation with the practice?
I, at the time, was on staff at Harvard University and MIT in Boston. I came down here for sometimes every week, sometimes every other week to see patients for that practice. I worked for it as an independent contractor. There were weeks where I did zero work for the practice. There were weeks where I did 40 hours worth of work for the practice.
Once you forwarded it, did you do anything else to get the patient the records? Did you follow up? Did you do anything with the practice?
The patient emailed me 7 days later or so. I think it was 7 days later that she hadn't gotten the records, at which time I called the people at the practice who handled the front desk and had access to the records to ask what's going on. They told me that the record request that I had forwarded on to them or printed out for them was insufficient by Virginia law. They directed me to the Virginia Board of Medicine's frequently asked questions, and I informed the patient by email that the practice requires a signed request for records. I emailed that back to her.
Now, my understanding from your filings is it's not simply a factual contest. You've also raised some legal arguments that aren't substantial evidence questions. There are others. And some of them seem to be premised on the notion that the board, administrative proceeding of the board, is the equivalent of a criminal prosecution. Assuming we disagree with you that the administrative proceeding of the board is not a criminal prosecution, what legal arguments regarding the proceedings in front of the board do you have left?
I think there are several. To the point of findings of fact errors, going back to that briefly, starting off with, in my assignments of error, what I've listed as point 26, where the board found that I provided incomplete records to patient MG. Patient MG was provided by people who worked for the practice, a Donnelly and Jin Park, was provided copies of his sleep study records. When the board finally provided a copy of the request that patient MG had sent, and they provided that in 2017 when this case had been filed back in 2009 or early 2010. So 7 years later, they provided a copy of the request for records. Patient MG only asked for his sleep study records. He didn't ask for all of his records. He asked for his sleep study records, and he received his sleep study records. So the finding that he was provided incomplete records is categorically false. The board's own documents of what records MG received refute that. No rational person could find he didn't get what he asked for. In terms of the several-month delay to his getting records, patient MG provided emails that he had sent to the practice around this time period. He notably never provided the email where he had allegedly sent a request for records. The electronic records of the practice keep track with serial numbers every single email that comes in from anyone, whether it goes to spam or otherwise, if it makes it through the email filters on the internet and it gets to the practice's servers. The first email from patient MG was not until March of 2010. The practice never got an email. He never provided evidence of sending an email. Therefore, to find that there was a several-month delay to responding to an email that he never provided a copy of and the practice never received, I don't believe substantial evidence supports. The finding of the board that I provided the records, that in the records of the board, it's clear that patient MG, his emails were back and forth with people who worked for the practice, not me. From Massachusetts.
Were you copied on any of those emails?
Generally not. Actually, on those emails, I had no idea that those emails even existed until I got them from the board sometime in March or April of 2017. That I had no idea that these emails had existed back in 2010. I guess I could have digged through the practice's electronic records to see every email that goes in and out, but there are hundreds of thousands of emails in the practice's system. There's millions of transactions. I honestly have not read through what every single person has sent, done, every doctor, every patient in the practice's records. I haven't read the yellow pages or
well, fortunately for you, the only thing we can look at is what's in the record. So if you've looked at what's in the record, then that's all you have to, that's the universe that you have to comment on.
So commenting on the universe of the record shows communications between patient MG and the staff of the practice, and the record shows absolutely no request by email from patient MG for his records. And the record of the DHP and of these proceedings clearly show that patient MG asked for his sleep studies. He got his sleep studies. Those were those 7 pages he received. He didn't receive the other 40, 50 pages of copies of his insurance card, his driver's license, office notes, because that's not what he asked for. If he'd asked for all of his records, he would have gotten all of his records.
What explains the lengthy delay, though?
The lengthy delay, if there was a lengthy delay, so there's no record of any email. He doesn't provide a copy of the email he sent. The practice didn't receive an email. He, in his complaint to the board, states that he mailed a request in February. He received the records, I think, on March 2nd or March 3rd in those emails. If he mailed it mid-February and he got it March 2nd, that's like a 2-week time lag. from when he put something in the mail to when Don or Jin or whoever at the practice opened that mail responded. I think Virginia gives either 15 or 21 days for a practice to respond. I'm not sure there, I don't think there was a lengthy delay. One aspect is, I don't think there was a delay. Two, he got the records that he requested, is clearly shown by the evidence. The third is that the records were not provided by me. The record clearly shows that Don and Jin sent him these records. And then in terms of Virginia law, I think 32.1.127.103 states that records are the property of the healthcare entity that maintains them. That's this business in Virginia that maintained them.
Well, but a doctor cannot insulate himself from regulation by saying it's the corporate entity that I work for, and therefore that's preventing me from performing consistent with the regulations as far as patient communication and records. You can't insulate yourself that way. I understand the argument you're making, but I would assume you understand the limitation of that argument.
I absolutely do. However, in any sense of justice, I should at least at some level be aware of the request by patient MG. Just as I'm sure the clerk's office gets requests that you never hear about, and I'm sure they generally respond to them. I can't imagine that once over some number of years, actually maybe there was never a delay at the clerk's office. In this case, the record clearly shows that the people who worked for the practice, they did respond to the request that they received.
You're into your rebuttal time. You can continue if you want,
okay,
or you can wait and respond.
To finish answering your question as it relates to patient JM, the request that she sent to me was legally insufficient as per Virginia law for private medical records, confidential medical records. The request that her doctors allegedly sent, one of them was addressed to a different doctor. It wasn't addressed to the practice or to where I worked or to me personally. And neither of those requests included permission or authority from the patient to release her medical records. If I go request your medical records from a doctor, but I don't have your permission, that's not a valid request. With regards to my other legal arguments, and I'm stretched for time because these are three different cases that spanned 7 years of administrative things that have been collapsed into one.
Well, thank you, Doctor. We do have your brief, and we're very familiar with that. So, again, you're using your rebuttal time, but if you want to respond at all to the board, you might want to say reserve some time, but feel free to use up the time if you want.
I'll wait to respond to the board. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Aaron Barrett on behalf of the Virginia Board of Medicine. Dr. Murcia was disciplined by the board for failure to provide patient records as requested. The decision was supported by substantial evidence in the record. Dr. Murcia also can't demonstrate that the board violated its constitutional rights or exceeded the scope of its authority.
How do you respond to the argument that you just heard that the only records that were requested were the sleep study and the patient got the sleep study?
The patient testified on the record that he requested on the record at the formal administrative hearing that he requested his patient records and did not receive them. Testamentary evidence is also evidence that's before the board. They aren't required to also have documentary evidence to back that up.
Didn't they have an email, though?
They had several emails. There were several emails from both of the patients that were at issue.
What did the email say?
I can't remember the specifics of the email. There were quite a few that went back and forth because, as Dr. Murcia said, he did respond directly to these patients at times from his own email account.
What about the fact that the practice got some requests that he never saw?
He testified that he never saw them, but the board ultimately was the determiner of credibility in this situation.
Was there any evidence of a CC to him on any of the emails?
Not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean it's not there. The record was quite voluminous.
What's the evidence that he did see them then?
The evidence that he did see them was that the patients testified that they communicated with him requesting the records. And the board listened to that testimony.
Communicated specifically with him or communicated with the practice?
I believe it was both, especially in the case of patient, I believe patient C was the female patient. She communicated directly with Dr. Murcia several times. Patient A testified that he communicated with Dr. Murcia requesting his records and that his doctor requested records as well.
Where in the record does it say that it was specifically communicated to him?
I believe it was in his testimony, which...
In whose testimony?
In patient A's testimony.
Okay.
Patient C, it wasn't all email communication. There was testimony, but essentially whether a phone conversation or in person, correct?
Yeah, patient C also testified to phone conversations, I believe more than one, with Dr. Murcia. But again, that testimony was before the board, and the board was the credibility determiner. Dr. Murcia testified to everything he stated here, that he did not have access to his records or was somehow unable to access practice records when he was the only clinician at that practice.
Did the board make any finding regarding his responsibility regarding the practice? Because we've heard a lot about they were potential failures by staff people. There are regulations that a doctor of a practice can be responsible for the failings of staff, but the board made no finding in that regard, or at least did not find him in violation of any supervisory responsibility.
Well, the board did make a finding that Dr. Murcia, and I don't remember the exact words, did not have the proper knowledge of a practitioner's responsibility for his patient records or something along those lines.
But never found that he failed in any responsibility to supervise staff regarding the production of records, or at least did not find a statutory violation.
No, but he was found in violation of the regulation that requires a practitioner to provide records in accordance with the Health Records Privacy Act, which Dr. Murcia has attempted to not have apply to him, but under the definitions in the Health Records Privacy Act, a doctor licensed by the Board of Medicine is a healthcare entity that is responsible for patient records.
What is the interaction or the rule when it comes to a doctor who is a contract doctor with a practice and the practice is responsible for billing and everything else?
There is no specific rule on that, Your Honor. The board would listen to testimony, I presume, on that issue, and did in Dr. Murcia's case. But there's no exception in the regulations for a doctor that states that he has nothing to do with billing or nothing to do with the IT department of his practice. He is still, under the regulations and under the Health Records Privacy Act, responsible for his patient records.
And I assume you have a case that supports that.
I have the statute that supports it. I don't know of any case that has specifically addressed the Health Records Privacy Act on that issue. But the definitions clearly tie a practitioner that is licensed by the Board of Medicine to patient records. And that practitioner is required to provide those patient records in accordance with the Health Records Privacy Act itself. And there is no exception in that rule for an individual who claims that he cannot lay hands on the records, particularly when, again, he testified to the board that he was the only clinician at that practice.
So your position is if the doctor gets notification that he needs to send records to somebody and the doctor requests that those records be sent by the entity, the practice, and the practice fails to do so, then the doctor is responsible?
Potentially. Again, this is a credibility determination issue.
Okay, so that's the board's function, essentially, to decide if it's the doctor or the practice.
Well, it's the board's function to determine if what the practitioner is representing to the board is credible and fits.
But that, I'm asking you a legal question, not a factual question. From a legal perspective, my question is, how do you determine if a doctor, let's assume that the only evidence in the record is that the doctor communicated the request to the practice and the practice failed to do what the doctor asked. Who's responsible?
Again, I believe that would be the board's determination under the interpretation of its own statute regarding patient record provision.
Okay. We've heard two things, and I think there's evidence, a lot of potentially conflicting evidence in the record, or maybe it's just the record so long. We've heard the doctor say, I was a contract physician, and he clearly testified that he was a contract physician. I've heard you say he was the only clinician with the practice. Now, Where in the record is there evidence that he was the only clinician with the practice?
He testified to that before the board twice.
What do you have?
I can locate it for you. Hold on just a minute.
I assume the board's position is if you're the only clinician with the practice, it doesn't matter what corporate form or structure you have formulated, you are in fact the practice for the purposes of medical record keeping.
I don't know that we can make a broad-based determination based on this one single case. Based on the facts that were before the board at this hearing, they determined that Dr. Murcia was responsible for those patient records and failed to provide them as required under law.
If he's the sole practitioner, the only person over whom the board has direct supervisory authority is him.
Yes.
So I'm looking. I don't want to interrupt you, but the cite to support that he's the sole practitioner.
Yes, he testified on, and this is under, Dr. Murcia presented these as like Appendix B. This is Appendix B, the transcript of the hearing, page 193 of 265 down at the bottom.
What's the hearing transcript?
It's 193.
Page 193.
Yes, and he stated, I'm the sole clinician who sees patients. And that was in response to several questions about the makeup of his business, because Dr. Murcia raised that issue, stating that he wasn't then responsible for the patient records because he could not access them. And the board's, when you look through the board's questioning of him, there were a lot of questions regarding, if you are the only medical doctor there, who else is responsible for these patients? The regulations require a doctor to be responsible for the patient records, and he was the only doctor there. Regarding Dr. Murcia's Dr. Murcia has made several other assignments of error here, including arguments that criminal constitutional protection should have applied to his formal administrative hearing. But he has not demonstrated how any of the allegations that were in the statement of particulars could have constituted a crime. He focuses on the statutes that it was alleged that he violated because they used the words defraud or fraud. But simply using the same words does not mean that those allegations would have constituted a crime and criminal constitutional protections were appropriate.
But even if a practitioner did something that could be criminal conduct, that does not prevent the board from taking an administrative action regarding the license, much in the same way the Virginia State Bar can suspend a lawyer for committing an illegal act.
Correct, but I believe his point is that criminal constitutional protections in various forms should have applied, such as the
board could not render a criminal punishment on him, could
correct,
it?
Yes. There is some case law that certain civil sanctions can rise to the level of punitive and therefore might be considered criminal, but none of those apply here, particularly where he has made no showing that any of the allegations constituted a crime. Even looking at fraud under Chapter 16 of Title 18.2, none of the fraud crimes that are detailed there fit the allegations here that I saw.
Here the penalty is mandatory education, not suspension of license or any other property, invasion of any other property right, correct?
Correct. He was issued a reprimand and ordered to take certain continuing medical education courses, I believe primarily in medical record keeping.
Counsel, you suggest in your brief that the findings of the board was based on testimony, investigative reports, exhibits, etc. You don't cite any specific information in your brief as to what constitutes the substantial evidence.
Well, I believe
that all... Can you maybe summarize some of the substantial evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, I could. There's the testimony of patients A and C, the testimony of the agency investigators. I believe two testified. One was more brief than the other. She was just documenting or presenting a foundation for her evidentiary report. There were the investigative reports that were presented to the board that I asked to be included in the appendix. I believe those alone would constitute substantial evidence that Dr. Murcia did not provide records in accordance with the regulation as cited by the board. And since he was really only, the only conclusions of law related to failure to provide these patients records, that's really all the court needs to look at for substantial evidence here. A reasonable mind could have found that the evidence that was before the board on patients A and C and what they stated to the board in their request for, and their doctor's request for their records, never being, or at least in...
So patient M is irrelevant?
Patient, he's calling patients by their initials. The board called them by actual letters. Patient A, I believe, is what he refers to as patient MG, and patient C, I think, is what he refers to as JM. Is that, that might have been a little confusion. But both of them testified that they did not receive their records in a timely manner when they requested. That verse and the documentary evidence, regardless of whether there's competing evidence in the record, does not mean that the board was required to give Dr. Murcia's testimony more weight than that of the testimony of the patients or the agency investigators.
And at a minimum, patient C testified on a, based on a conversation that she was told she would get the records by Dr. Murcia, and she didn't get the records in the time frame suggested by their conversation.
She testified she never got the records. As of the date of the hearing, she had never received the records.
But she testified that he specifically promised her she would get the records.
I believe so, yes. Dr. Murcia has made several statutory authority arguments. He has claimed that the board admitted evidence that lacked relevance, but he hasn't pointed to where this irrelevant or prejudicial evidence is, and it is not included in the appendix. He's also alleged that the board violated Virginia Code 2.24021, which argument was waived. It was not raised to this court until his second amended opening brief. And even if he had not waived it, that statute simply doesn't apply here. That's a statute to permit people before an agency to notify an agency after a proceeding that a decision is due within 90 days. If the agency does not produce the decision in 90 days, findings of fact are deemed waived in favor of the respondent before the agency. Dr. Murcia here points to an email from 2013 where he asked, has the board come to a decision? And 2013 was before he was even noticed for his informal conference in 2014.
As far as the series of delays, as I understand things, during this process, Dr. Murcia requested multiple continuances over time.
Yes, he requested multiple continuances, filed writs of mandamus in Fairfax Circuit Court against the agency, filed for an injunction against the board to stop the proceeding when his final continuance request was not granted, and generally assisted with the delay. Dr. Murcia also argues, I believe in his, he makes it a constitutional claim, but it's really statutory, that the board was required to vote by unanimous decision. It's a statutory, the two statutory provisions permit the board to vote by majority to sanction licensees. The other arguments that Dr. Murcia raises, I've addressed on brief. Unless the court has any additional questions, the board would request that the board's order be upheld and the Fairfax Circuit Court decision be upheld.
Thank you, Ms. Baird. When she clears out, the podium is yours again. But and please, and I do have, I'll lead off with a question. The clock will count down the remainder of your time. On page 193 of the hearing transcript, and there's a lot of back and forth between you and one of the board members regarding who owns the practice, where the money's going, who's working for who, because they're trying to figure out what's the, for lack of a better term, who's responsible. Who's the person that the board oversees who's responsible? And ultimately, regarding the time period in question, the court reporter has you saying, I'm the sole clinician who sees patients. Given that, why isn't it reasonable to believe that you are the healthcare provider who's responsible ultimately for the patients getting the records?
So, a clarification, I was the sole sleep clinician who saw patients?
That's not what the testimony is. The testimony is I'm the sole clinician who sees patients, and it's and the questions before it weren't limited to sleep, and it was you and your wife, and then you said she's not my wife. In 2008, when the practice started, she saw some patients, but by this time she had left, I was the sole clinician seeing patients. Why isn't that in, why does that, even if that's incorrect, okay, but given that it was your testimony, why isn't that enough for a rational fact finder, if they believe that statement, and we don't get to say whether it's right or wrong, they get to say whether it's right or wrong to say, you are the sole medical provider for the practice, and therefore you're the one who's responsible ultimately for the patient records.
If that were true, that would be the case.
And you understand we don't get to decide what's true or not.
I understand that.
Okay.
With regards to the first...
Well, let me ask you a follow-up on that, and we'll make sure you have a little bit of time, but let me ask you a follow-up on that. Is there anything that you can think of that's in the record that would refute that point, that you're the sole clinician or sole practitioner? Is there anything that was in the record that would dispute that?
I believe that the record and the notes for various patients include handwriting or other comments by other providers of care. There are registered polysomnography technologists. There are physician assistants who see patients.
So that was before the board, right?
But all of those people have to practice under the supervision of a physician, do they not?
And there were also other physicians, including Dr. Pense. In terms of the first delay, since it's fresh on my mind, the first time I requested any continuance was in 2014. These cases were filed in 2009 and 2010. It was 5 years later, and I requested a short...
When you say the cases were filed, is 2009 when a patient filed a complaint with the board? Is 2010 when the patient filed a complaint with the board, or is that the time when they have notified you that the board has investigated a complaint and is taking action? Because the case really doesn't start until you get a letter directing you that the board thinks you are in violation.
So for patient A, it was the complaint date was, for patient C, the complaint date was March 9th of 2010. For the other patient, the complaint date was November or December of 2009.
That's when they filed a complaint with the board.
That's when they filed a complaint with the board. That's when the board investigated it and filed their report findings.
But your case doesn't start until the board notifies you that they believe they've conducted an investigation in violation, because a lot of the regulatory boards get lots of complaints that the person complained of never finds out anything because they investigate it and find nothing. The case starts when you're notified that there's a potential problem that the board's looking at. When was that?
I was notified on the investigation was completed April of 2010 and was received back by the board on May 12th of 2010 for patient C, MG. For the other patient, the board I was notified in November or December of 2009, and the board received the investigative report in December of 2009, 5 years before.
You're technically over time, but since Judge Decker promised you something, and I never want anybody to say she's not right, you've got until 1 minute and 15 seconds shows on that clock.
Okay, so it was 5 years after I was notified that there was a problem, and an investigatory report was filed. In terms of at the actual hearing, all of the witnesses said they're going based on written records because this was now 8 years after the fact. In terms of my own recollections, I never talked to either of these two patients about their records. With one of the patients, patient JM or patient A, I had two emails with her back in 2009, both of which are amongst the records that you have. In terms of the delays and how they prejudiced me, if these cases, after the DHP investigated them, after they'd interviewed me, after they'd taken the records, after reports were submitted to the board, if in 2010, 11, 12, they had actually come back with a hearing, and I asked them every year, what's the decision on this? The people who worked for the practice, the Don Lee and Jin Park, whose emails you see, with the patients, those people still worked there. They could have said what exactly happened, whether they spoke to anyone, how they handled those records requests. By waiting until 2014, I had no access to any of that information.
Thank you for the argument. I gave you even more time than I said than Judge Decker had promised you. So,
thank you.
The case is submitted. We'll come down and greet Dr. Machia and counsel consistent with the traditions of the court.